Welcome everyone to episode 47 of the Edges and Sledges Cricket Podcast. It's been a welcome blackout for Indian cricket fans, but there's still plenty going on in the rest of the world. Sri Lanka is in South Africa, the PSL has just started, and the BBL has just finally concluded with the Melbourne Stars losing to the Melbourne Renegades. The Melbourne Stars actually lost 7 wickets for 39 runs to lose by 13 runs while chasing 145. But I think everyone is just glad that the BBL's over. I'm your host DJ from London, and I'm joined as usual by Varun from Singapore. Plus this week, we've got a very special guest on the show. Now, if you listened to our episode last week, we briefly discussed the banners that came up in Eden Park in Wellington. So when Tasneem got in touch with us to answer our listener quiz, we jumped at the chance to speak to her. And the way cricket Twitter works, we feel like we've known Taz for ages, but it's actually the first time we're speaking. Taz is a law academic, a cricket commentator, a guerrilla cricket contributor, and a blogger at Girls with Cricket Balls. So Taz, thanks so much for joining us on the Edges and Sledges Cricket Podcast this week.
Thanks, guys, for having me.
So let's get the easy stuff out of the way, right? We ask all our guests this question. How did you get into cricket and how did you get involved with cricket?
I think when you're from a South Asian background, cricket is always there, you know? I was born right at the end of the 80s, so one of my earliest memories is Pakistan's World Cup win from 1992. And as you guys know, there were a lot of pretty significant players in that era, enough to keep you interested in the game. And that's kind of where it started. I played as a kid. I played growing up. I played at university. So I always kind of just stayed with cricket as one of my main sports and one of the things that I really enjoy. Getting into cricket, as in being involved, was something a little bit more recent. When I moved to London, I joined the Guerrilla team, which, as you guys know, are a commentary team that commentate on England matches and the rest of the world. So I joined these guys about a year and a half ago, and then we got the very cool opportunity to be Ireland's official test match commentators for their incredibly exciting first test match, which was against Pakistan last May. And it kind of just went from there. You know, like one opportunity presented itself and then the next. And I've just done a couple of little things like commentary and working in the media, working with leagues, helping a little bit with the administrative side. So yeah, it's kind of just come out from there. And I feel that some of it's a little bit natural because of my law and politics background. I think there's a lot of overlap with sports, particularly human rights and international law and sports, because sport is used relatively commonly as a tool in international development.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, I think one of the reactions whenever there's conflict between India and Pakistan is that we're going to stop playing cricket. So it's interesting that you actually mentioned the interaction between sport and international politics. But just moving on to what's recently happened, while we were putting together this podcast, we put together a bunch of topics to speak about. But I think a lot of that's just been blown away with what happened yesterday. And so I'm just going to come to Varun first. And Varun, there's a new KP in town, and it's not South Africa's old friend, Kevin Peterson. It's Kushal Pereira with his 153 not out. Now, I just want to unpack that innings a little bit. I think he'd failed a drug test a couple of years ago, and the Sri Lanka board helped him through that. He was concussed 2 weeks ago in Canberra, and he's been battered and he was bruised in this innings as well. I think Olivier hit him on the helmet as well. He got a few in the ribs. But guys, is this the greatest test innings that's ever been played? Varun, you first.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I was unfortunate to not have seen it, but I was following it very closely on Cricket Info and Cricket Buzz. And it was phenomenal. I mean, the guy, 153, five sixes with a couple of sixes coming towards the end. It just showed the grit and determination when I look at this kind of an innings. I think he carried on the good form he had in the first innings. He was the only Sri Lankan batsman to get past 50. He hit 51. And you know, DJ, you and I were saying this a little earlier. We can't remember if he's the guy who everyone touted to be the next Jayasurya, but his strike rate certainly seems to be talking about similar kind of performance. He hit 80 strike rate in the first innings, close to 80 in the second innings. I can't remember the last time there was such a good fourth innings chase. I was following it online with a friend as well, and everyone said this is the thing about Test cricket, right? That Sri Lanka is going to come to 15 runs to win, and they're going to lose. That's just how Test cricket works. But this guy just changed the game.
Taz, were the shades of Brian Lara's innings against Australia in there? The other 153 not out that we remember?
So I, like Varun, was unlucky enough to not be watching live, but I was following it very closely. I've been watching parts of the match throughout the first and second days. And then by the time the third day rolled around, so did work and deadlines. So I'd missed a lot of the fun. I don't know about Shades of Brian Lara just because I don't really love comparisons with cricketers from other generations and different times. I think everything has its own magic. And I think Varun mentioned a lot of it. How often do we get to see a fourth innings chase that's A, successful, and successful with one wicket remaining? I think when he came in, Sri Lanka looked to be in a almost impossible to win situation. I think a lot of people probably wrote it off. When I saw that there was one wicket remaining, I thought, okay, well, there's not a lot of point following this. And then as soon as I checked ESPN, it quickly switched. I think, you know, you mentioned his strike rate. You mentioned the difficulty of chasing in the fourth innings, particularly against a bowling attack that is A, in their home conditions, and B, consists of Steyn, Philander, Dwan Olivier, Rabada, even Maharaj. It's a really, really, really strong attack. And Sri Lanka have just had a series loss against England that was pretty conclusive, seemed relatively one-sided, and definitely didn't give you shades of a team that could go and win in one of the most difficult cricketing conditions to play in. So I think whether or not I feel Brian Lara with 153 not out, all I know, it was amazing, and I really regret not being able to watch it live.
Yeah, I think it was just an incredible innings to put on 78 for the last wicket and to win a game. I mean, it was just fantastic. I started watching it when there was about 50 to get, and the tension by the end of it was just unbearable. And what a turnaround for Sri Lanka, who've just lost 2-0 to Australia. A lot of the commentary around it has been how poor Sri Lanka was, and other podcasts have just kind of written Australia winning against Sri Lanka off, saying that it's a poor team. And England have beaten Sri Lanka, as you said, as well, at home. And with the West Indies resurgence against England and Sri Lanka starting to win again, I think this is actually the right time for the Test Championship to start. So I personally was pretty happy with the result. Let's see what happens in the second test. If they can draw it, they'll be the first Asian team to actually win a series in South Africa, which will be an incredible, incredible achievement for this team. Moving on, Taz, you recently wrote an article on your blog, Girls with Cricket Balls, and it was called Cricket Needs More Than a Me Too Movement. So I read the article and I was very impressed by it, but tell us a little bit about what prompted you to write this article.
So my field in law is international law and international humanitarian law quite specifically. So a lot of my work has been focused on situations of armed conflict. Now, you guys are probably aware that rape is weaponized during armed conflict in absolutely staggering and crazy numbers. The main markers of rape is that it comes out of situations where there is a disparity in power. Now, this is something that can arise in every single industry, particularly industries that are socially valued, like entertainment, like sports, things that can be broadcast and garner ratings. Your question as to what prompted me to write it, well, this is a topic that I have to think about a lot for work anyway. Just in general, that the legal aspect of it and the ways in which we can engage society to try and move towards a slightly different world. So with the cricket Me Too situation, there have been a lot of events in world sport generally. Obviously, there's the Ronaldo situation, which is, I think, maybe one of the most significant things to come out of sport, even if it hasn't necessarily been addressed correctly. But it seems that that most industries are having a moment where they try and recognize some of the gender issues, whether that it involves sexual harassment or rape or general disparities of power and equality. I think that sports, cricket in particular, is very, very ripe for such a moment because we had the jury case. I mentioned in the article the Alex Hepburn case, which is unfolding in England. He's currently undergoing a retrial. And then we've got the case in New Zealand that I talked about briefly as well, which I found particularly interesting because New Zealand are the only country to have formally addressed consent and issues surrounding consent in their code of conduct. I think there's a lot to talk about with the Me Too thing. When you work in a field or get a little up close experience, as opposed to just watching from home or on your TV, you get to see the ins and outs of something and the subtle ways in which problems continue to occur. So I really think that that my, I don't know, last almost 1 year of working in cricket, rather than just being a spectator, has given me the opportunity to observe a lot of things in practice. I've also had a lot of time to mull over some of them and think about what the dangerous aspects of them are and how we continue to propagate negative ideas of sexuality and gender equality in the sport.
That's very interesting. Thanks, Des. We'll put out a link in the show notes to the article. It's definitely something everyone must read. It's really well written. So well done on that. Speaking of negative connotations about sexuality, the other thing that we wanted to talk about this week was what happened in St. Lucia. As I'm sure you're all aware, there was a test series that was on between England and the West Indies. The West Indies had won 2-0 and the third test was played in St. Lucia. England did win that test, but what actually took the limelight was Shannon Gabriel's exchange with Joe Root. Now, since then, there have been a number of articles and lots of commentary around that exchange, but I'm just going to refer to Shannon Gabriel's statement where he says what he actually said to Joe Root and what Joe Root reacted and said. So he says it was a tense moment in the game, and he recognized that he was attempting to break through his own tension when he said to Joe Root, "Why are you smiling at me? Do you like boys?" Now, Joe Root replies, which was the bit that was picked up by the microphone, "Don't use it as an insult. There's nothing wrong with being gay." Guys, I'm going to come to the issues of stump mics and things later, but what do you guys make of this exchange? Gabriel was obviously banned for 4 games by the ICC because of the homophobic insult. Varun, your thoughts on this whole situation?
Yeah, so I think, I don't know, I'm trying to think of other cases of where people are sledging and they talked about their wives and grandmothers. And I do want to say, I think this is along the same kind of line. I think it is unacceptable. And I think Joe Root's reply was a really fitting one. And of course, he's got a lot of kind of positive response over that. I don't know Shannon Gabriel. I don't know his background. I haven't followed him enough to know whether like Ian Bishop and all are saying he's a good guy, he didn't mean it. But yeah, man, I think these kind of things are not acceptable.
Taz, your take on the Shannon Gabriel-Joe Root exchange?
You know, I think it's incredibly complicated, and I think it requires a lot of nuance when you're analyzing it. And I think that 99% of the articles that I have read, at least, whether or not it's all of the ones out there, have not captured any of that nuance. It has very much been painted a story of a LGBT ally versus a homophobe, and I think that's pretty inaccurate. Look, there's absolutely no place in sport for anything negative like racism, homophobia, sexism, etc., etc. But I think it is a complicated matter when you're trying to cross cultures and have cross-cultural conversations. There are values that exist in certain parts of the world that are not necessarily the same values in other parts. When it comes to things like racism or homophobia, it's never acceptable to say, oh, it's the culture of X place. And of course, that is not the argument that I'm giving. My point here is, as much as I also agree with what Joe Root said, there's nothing wrong with being gay, don't turn it into an insult. That is something that takes generations of conversation and thought to get out of your culture. When I was 15 years old, all of the kids that I went to school with used to say, "That's so gay," to mean that's negative, that's a bad thing. That's something that we are slowly all working on within our culture to get rid of. Joe Root is maybe a couple of years, 2 years younger than me or so. So he grew up in the same English culture that uses gay as a negative connotation. As much as I admire what he said, I wonder if he has had that same conversation with Ben Stokes and Alex Hales, who... Well, I probably shouldn't add Alex Hales in there because Ben Stokes was the one who probably made the remarks to the gay couple in that famous incident in the nightclub. So it would be nice if this would be a blanket thing that we use everywhere and not just in the heat of the moment when it's sledging and that's our response to sledging. I'm not saying that Joe is disingenuous because that would involve knowing a lot more about Joe as a person, the conversations that those guys have when they're off the field, et cetera, et cetera. But it was the bare minimum in terms of LGBT rights. And yeah, that's something that you expect and want from your captain. Shannon Gabriel, on the other hand, said something in the heat of the moment that he may or may not believe in. We don't know. Again, we don't know enough about these guys to know about that. We do, however, know that the Caribbean culture is not in the same place as England is in terms of LGBT rights. There are several islands in which, as a remnant of colonial laws, it's still illegal to engage in homosexual relationships. That's something that's troubling, but it's not something that can be corrected by Joe Root, the ICC, or anything like that. It is good to have those conversations because ultimately it is the responsibility of that native culture to address whatever thoughts or issues they have about homosexuality and the way in which they need to move forward with it. I do agree that there are definitely some issues in Caribbean culture. When I was in Canada this summer, I was with one of the West Indian players. We were talking about, we were just having a conversation, and he was asking me whether or not I play cricket. So, you know, obviously I responded, yes, I'm a wicketkeeper batsman, et cetera, et cetera. And we had a long conversation. He then came to, are you a lesbian?
Wow. Wow.
Yeah. It just caught me off guard because I didn't know where it came from until I walked away from that conversation. He then finished with, when I said, no, I'm not, but why are you asking me that? Like, what's the relevance of this to this conversation? He responded with, only gay girls play sports. Now, I am not saying that this individual's thought process is emblematic of an entire culture of islands, right? This is a unique thing about the West Indies. It's not a country, unlike Pakistan, India, England, etc., etc. It's a collection of places. So I'm not saying it's something that's unique to them or it's emblematic of their entire culture, but there are definitely things to address there. And I think those things are probably best addressed by the people whose culture it's native to.
That's really interesting. Thank you for that. Moving on, I just wanted to ask the peripheral question that's come out of this, which is Sanjay Manjrekar's tweet about stump mics. Now, Sanjay Manjrekar said, after Sarfaraz, it's Shannon Gabriel who could now be in trouble thanks to stump mics. The ICC must brainstorm and decide if increased use of stump mics is actually good for the game or not. Now, my view on this was put the stump mics up, get everyone to hear whatever's going on, make sure everything is captured and can be used against a player if they're being racist, homophobic, sexist, whatever it is. Moin Ali seems to agree with that, and he said that, yes, if the incident that allegedly happened in Australia, we would have straightened it out if we had a stump mic that captured everything. Conversely, Trevor Bayliss, who's in the England camp and is the England coach, says that the things that happen in the heat of the moment, people should not be held accountable for those actions when they are angry and just spewing stuff. So the stump mic should be turned down between deliveries. There's another view on Twitter, which I think it's the Cricketing View handle, which said that the stump mics will not capture everything. So often you'll get a one-way exchange and then you'll just prejudge the issue. So guys, where do you stand on this? Varun, what do you think about the use of stump mics and how they should be, whether they should be turned up? Should they be turned down? Should they be removed completely?
So DJ, I'm totally with you here. I think they should be turned up. Of course, there's a caveat that you can't just have the stump mics and no commentators, etc. So I think it has to be, for TV viewership, there has to be a balance. But I say turn the stump mics on, listen to everything that's going on. And yeah, I mean, if you want to be in the heat of the moment and say something, then say it openly, right? You can't, don't come back and regret what you've said later just because you're on the field. And yeah, and if it's not racist, if it's not homophobic, if it's genuinely about the game, I actually don't see an issue with that. So I think it's really ridiculous that Manjrekar said that ICC needs to consider whether it's good or not. In fact, I was reading tweets. I think he got trolled massively. People are comparing this tweet to saying that, yeah, then you shouldn't have invigilators in exams and, you know, that cheating is okay. And so, yeah, things have gotten a little out of hand, but I think you shouldn't have anything to hide.
You know, the tweet I love the most from Sanjay Manjrekar is the one in which he advocates Virat Kohli being dropped from the test team. I mean, we dig that tweet out occasionally and just retweet it for fun. But anyway, Taz, your thoughts on Sanjay Manjrekar's tweet about stump mics being turned down so people aren't basically caught doing whatever they do?
It's a difficult one, isn't it? As much as I respect all of our views and our ability to have them, I thought that Moin Ali's was probably the most persuasive. This is a guy who is most directly affected by the situation. Look, number one, the stump mic's purpose is not to catch people saying shitty things and then action them. The stump mics are there for the cricket. But a nice byproduct of this is the ability to use it as like an invigilation system, right? Muin Ali's incident that you mentioned, by the sounds of it, what was said to Muin Ali, who I think might be one of the most easy to believe characters in the whole of global cricket, right, was the gravity of what was said to him. It was probably something that is a lot more intense than any of the sledging incidents that we have heard on field in recent memory. So I'm a little bit concerned by this. Turn them down so we can't hear what these guys are saying to each other. Because I think in the case of Muin Ali, that definitely qualifies as a hate crime. If that happened and it wasn't on a field, look, the law and society and culture and everything, they don't go away just because things are happening in the context of a match. What was said to Muin Ali about him being a terrorist, and it's not the first time that things like that have been said to Muin Ali, sometimes by English people, sometimes by people that the English media continues to prop up and represent and retweet and employ. I wonder if you guys can guess who I'm talking about. It's definitely not the first time.
Does the name start with M?
Wow, you know what? You might be a mind reader. I think that it's the wrong approach to say that they should be turned down. I respect Cricketing View's perspective that, like in the Shannon Gabriel situation, not everything was caught. We did guess the context correctly because of Joe Root's response. But of course, there are the possibility of times where you can't guess the context. And in those situations, the reality is the umpire is standing next to that person. They heard. Even in situations where the umpire says, oh, I don't really know what was said, I didn't hear everything, you hear. You're standing right there and half your job is to pay attention to what's going on. I think for me, Muin Ali's perspective that no, if the stump mics had been on that day, what was said to me would have been heard and would have been actioned is pretty interesting. I don't think the purpose... So we've got to ask ourselves another question, especially with the Safraz incident, with the Shannon Gabriel incident, and with the type and quality and level of sledging that does go on today, where it does involve issues like protected characteristics of sexuality, race, et cetera, et cetera. What is the purpose of overhearing a guy like Shannon Gabriel saying something negative? Is it for us to vilify him? Is it for people to say, stop playing cricket against the West Indies? If this is their disgusting culture, then they can be, you know, like cast aside and we won't condone them. I don't think so. I think we need to sometimes take a step back and look at the purpose. If the purpose is to proverbially ruin somebody's life or ostracize them, then okay, people are doing a great job at that. But if the purpose is to build a society where we can all live together cohesively, happily, in a positive, enabling environment, which allows everybody to flourish, then it's good to hear these things and have the appropriate response to them.
Yeah, and for me, I mean, the way I see it is that there are two ways of looking at the stump mics. One is as an invigilation system, as we've been talking. The other is an entertainment system, which is how I think Tim Payne used it pretty well during the India-Australia series. And just the other point I wanted to make was that we wouldn't get away with this kind of language and behavior at work. So why should the cricketers be allowed to do that? And that is the bit that no one's actually answered. Why should cricketers, just because they play cricket at the top level, be allowed to get away with it? And what it does is, it seems to permit that you've got the license to be rude and abusive just because you're playing a sport, which, I mean, surely that cannot be right.
And let me also ask both of you, like, what do you think is stopping Muin Ali from coming out and naming the player and exactly what was said right now? And I'm just curious, do you think a stump mic would have helped him have that proof or evidence to be able to say it, knowing that if he was to come out today and name a particular player, it'll go into a whole legal trial, they'll use other words, or a monkey gate type of incident will happen where there's no proof, they're not able to do it. Do you think that is what it is?
You know what? I think it's probably a mixture of things. I think that when you are from a minority, whatever that minority may be, and look, Muin Ali has the unique experience of playing as a minority within his team, unlike the Indians and the Pakistanis who are playing for their respective, their origin countries, if you like. I think it's a little bit difficult. There's a lot of onus on you. You are a walking, talking representation. So I think the pressure increases. I think if what was said to him was said in the presence of a Ben Stokes or a Joe Root or a whoever teammate, someone on his side, I think the situation would have been different. He is alone in this. Whatever a stump mic would have picked up, the onus would have not been on him to report it. It's the same reason that bullying doesn't get reported. It's the same reason why I could write an entire list of guys who are inappropriate and probably should be named and shamed to some level in the whole Me Too concept. But then the concern becomes, why is the onus on one individual to do any of that? Why? And then we all know what happens. There's a level of disbelief. The responses to Moinelli will all be the same. They'll be, oh, it was just banter. Oh, he didn't mean it. Oh, it was in the heat of the moment. Oh, it occurred in anger. So this kind of almost neutral seeming, not actually neutral, but this neutral seeming aspect of technology means that it takes a lot of weight off of Moin's shoulders, which I think is probably what Moin needs. I think the man is just trying to play cricket well for his home country. And the shame of it is that people like the gentleman whose name begins with an M or whoever it may be won't allow him to do that. For some reason, Moin Ali, when he stands on the field, is always going to have to represent, you know, like Birmingham Muslims or British, like, people who have managed to quote unquote assimilate into their new culture, whatever it is. So I think there's a lot of weight on his shoulders, and he probably does not want anything outside the game coloring it or being what he is known for. I think that's a normal feeling, and I think a lot of that pressure would be taken away with the stump mics being turned up.
It's just a he said, she said situation, right? It's just the word of one player against another, and it goes nowhere, and that's where we've ended up, where the Cricket Australia has apparently investigated and nothing's come out of it, and the ECB isn't pursuing it, and Moin Ali has just been kind of left to say, okay, this had happened, but that's what I thought happened. The other guy says, no, it didn't happen, and that's where it ends up. It is, as you said, it's what Monkeygate was, because there were no stump mics. There was, at least there you had Hayden or somebody else kind of stepping up, and you had Sachin stepping in for Harbhajan. And then those two cancelled each other out. But here you don't have either of those things. No stump mics and no teammates. And I think there's no evidence of the allegation. And that's where we end up. Anyway, guys, on that note, I think we'll take a quick break. We'll be back with hopefully some lighter topics after the break. So we'll see you after this break. Welcome back after the break. Guys, the Associate Quadrangular tournament is currently being played in Oman. And Taz, I know you're a big supporter of Associate Cricket. Tell us a little bit about the Oman Quadrangular.
So I could not fail to emphasize the fact that Associate Cricket right now is absolutely lit. The quality and the standard is building so quickly. And I think a lot of that is probably to do with international T20 leagues. I think it's definitely helped. So what we've got here is a T20 quadrangular series that's being held in Oman. You guys probably know that T20s now have international status. The ranking system, although never perfect and always needs addendums when we're discussing it, shows that Scotland are probably firmly on top. They're ranked in the T20 rankings as number 11. The Netherlands are 13, and then Ireland are 17, and Oman are the final team at 18. Now, that's a range of seven standings. So that probably doesn't indicate just how close some of the matches are or have been, but they've been amazing. It's been a really, really high level of cricket. Much tighter matches than you would expect, really. The Netherlands have thus far won two. One of them against Scotland was an incredibly tight match that they won with one ball remaining. It probably really helped that they had Ryan Tendiscata as a finisher who, you know, I would say in world cricket, I know there's, you know, Dhoni exists and Dinesh Karthik is also amazing. And that's one of the reasons that I don't ever really like saying, oh, so-and-so is the best or whatever, because there's a range of people with amazing talents. But Ryan Tendiscata is one of the guys that if my life depended on finishing a match, I'd be like, yeah, go ahead. The man will not take unnecessary risks and he'll bring the game home. But despite a player of the quality of Tendo, we've got so many tight matches, particularly with Ireland, Scotland, and the Netherlands. Today's match that you referenced earlier was maybe one of the best finishes I've gotten to see in a decent amount of time, I'd say. absolute final ball thriller, and Stuart Poynter ended up hitting a final ball six. I don't think any Ireland fan thought that that was going to happen, but that final ball six won them the match. And the only thing that I'd really add is that this is being live streamed on Oman's YouTube channel, which, you know, has really had its share of problems. There's been a lot of tech issues. On top of that, it's only a single camera angle. There's no commentary. So, you know, some of the thrill of this amazing quadrangular series has definitely been lost to tech issues. But I think it really indicates that the time is very much ripe for innovation in associate cricket in terms of how they play. If you just look at the numbers from today, Vizay scored 78 off of 36. Now, those are the type of innings that if Andre Russell did it, we would A, all have the pleasure of being able to see it and watch it and access it, and we would not be robbed of the absolute fun of that. And then secondly, we would not stop hearing Andrew Russell's name, and rightfully so. It's not really about Russell himself. It's just about the way in which associate cricket is generally treated, which is a shame. I think if you're going to keep having very, very tight series like these, then it really indicates that time for innovation in the way in which we engage with associate cricket, in the way in which it's put out there, is, you know, really coming to a bit of a zenith. And broadcasters, I think, are going to start looking at associate cricket very, very soon. You guys have probably heard that there's going to be a European T20 league probably this summer. So I think eyes are going to start moving in the direction of associate cricket very, very, very quickly. We've just had two associate teams last year who have been catapulted to full nation status. And although I don't think that the ICC is probably super eager to add another couple to those, I'm telling you, a team like Scotland is fast on the trails of full member status.
Awesome. And do you see the World Cup being expanded? There's a huge debate, I think, to be had about whether the World Cup should be a tournament of that only allows 10 teams to participate in it, because the current format is only a 10-team World Cup, and the 2023 World Cup will be 10 teams as well. Whereas somewhere like FIFA, they're looking to grow their World Cup and make it bigger. Now, do you think that the one-day World Cup will be expanded to include more associate nations, or is it more in the T20 area that we could do that, given it takes an entire day to play with 50 over game, whereas you could fit in 2-3 games in a T20 World Cup, for example?
So I probably have a super unpopular opinion here that I'm going to preface by saying I know that a lot of people disagree, but I don't love ODIs anymore. I am finding less and less of a value for them personally in my life. That doesn't mean that they shouldn't happen, but T20s work great because they fit in with everybody's work schedule and they have a great atmosphere. Test matches are just test matches. Like, what more can you say? It is the pinnacle of cricket. It literally is the test of your skills, your mental power. And I think that's what Kushal Pereira showed a lot of, was mental stamina, which really isn't easy about a test match. So for me, the relevance of ODIs is starting to fall away a little bit anyway. Now, I'm not going to make a statement as broad as I'm boycotting the 10-team World Cup, but it fills me with zero excitement. It's happening in my home country, England. It's, you know, and I'm a big fan of English wickets in terms of they have enough in them that they're not going to necessarily alienate certain teams from certain parts of the world entirely, unlike e.g. Australian wickets can do. So as cool as the World Cup could be, I think that 10-team part really makes it a little bit less exciting for me, particularly when, like you mentioned, my focus is associate cricket with my work for Gorilla. So I am very intimately aware of what associate teams are doing and the standard and quality of where they stand, which, by the way, is incredibly competitive. You guys all saw the Asia Cup where Hong Kong was this close to beating India, aka arguably one of the best ODI teams in the world. And Hong Kong is not as strong an associate team as maybe a Scotland is, for example, or even a Netherlands. So I think that that's really limiting for cricket in general. You mentioned FIFA. The ICC, for me, might be the only organization that has commissioned a piece of research and then thought, forget what this research says, let's carry on as we intend to anyway. Last year, the ICC had a very conclusive and encompassing piece of research that looked at cricket fans globally. It looked at their demographics, it looked at where they were based, it looked at their age ranges, it looked at their genders, it looked at a whole lot of host of information that we probably did not really understand completely. One of the things that came out of it was the fact that there are 20 million pre-existing cricket fans in the US. Okay, that's not the amount of people that can be targeted and switched into cricket fans, which I think is a large section of the world. I worked in Canada at the GT20, so I saw all the English or white Canadians, rather than people from a Pakistani background or West Indian background or whatever, who are expats who have this pre-existing love for cricket. There were 80-year-old Canadian, native Canadians coming to matches and saying, "This is really cool." Telling me that they printed out the instructions and the rules for cricket, and they sat there for an entire day watching Steve Smith, who they didn't even know who he was or understand the relevance of Steve Smith playing in a small place like the Maple Leaf Cricket Ground. And they loved it. And they were there to be flipped and turned into cricket fans, which I think is not a difficult a task as the ICC are pretending by ignoring it completely. Like you said, FIFA's looking to expand and service its global fans. The ICC appears to be the only body that is not actively pursuing that and is instead maybe focusing a little bit too much, whether it's on the big three or the pre-existing Indian subcontinent market. You know, both things can be argued. But absolutely, the time is ripe for associate cricket. The skills have never been better, and the tiny, tiny gulf between associate teams and established teams probably really only exists due to resources and the professionalization of the game and the amount of time that's passed for the countries doing it. So I really do think that this 10-team World Cup is a shame. And in all honesty, there are a lot of associate fixtures around the same time as the 10-team World Cup that my eyes are probably going to be focused on. Ireland, although it's no longer an associate team, I think it's too early to call it an established team. You've got to really allow it some time to come into its own. Ireland are having a tri-series with the West Indies and Bangladesh right before the World Cup. And then sometime around the same time, Scotland are hosting Afghanistan and Sri Lanka, which I am already so excited and so pumped for, having been at the Scotland-Pakistan T20s, which maybe in all the cricket that I have attended or worked at or whatever, might have been my all-time favorite environment, because it was just pure joy, pure cricketing love. And I think that we just need a lot more of that.
Awesome. So I'm not going to ask you about the World Cup that's coming up, given that you're not into one-day cricket anymore. But Varun, let me just come to you very quickly on the other piece of news that broke this week, and that was the Australia versus India squad. Now, there has been a bit of a cricketing blackout for Indian cricket fans, which I don't think we're really complaining about, given that it's so hard to follow the amount of cricket these guys play. But I wanted to ask you about the squad that the Indian selectors have actually picked, Varun, for this series, these five ODIs. You've got Pant coming back in. You've got KL Rahul that's come back in, which is interesting. And Kohli and Bumrah, those two guys are back in. The people who've gone out are Khalil, DK, Jadeja, and Bhuvi's been rested. Now, I think we all expected Khalil to be out, right? Given his performance and his atrocious catching. But talk me through DK being left out. I think we wanted Pant to come in, but at the expense of Dinesh Karthik? Is that the right move? And I'll just preface that by, we put a poll out on Twitter, and we got about 85 votes, 69% of which said it was the wrong call. But there were a few interesting and quite strong opinions about DK's abilities in ODI. So, Varun, what are your thoughts on DK being left out for this? And is this the end of the road for him for World Cup selection?
DJ, I'm totally and thoroughly confused. I can't understand, and I think my frustration is just with the fact that you have been playing this guy for the last one and a half years in anticipation of this World Cup. And of course, if his form is not good, if he's not doing his job, definitely replace him. But he's pretty good. I mean, even Tass mentioned it today. He's one of the best finishers India has today. He's kind of got that clarity of mindset when he comes into that role. He can hit the ball out of the ground, which is a problem that we have been discussing for a while. So honestly, I can't understand this. I've been reading a lot about it. Some people are saying it's because DK's cohort is secure. That's why they're experimenting. Some people are saying this is the end of the road for DK. I can't understand it. I'm also a little bit confused because some people are saying Panth, and I know DJ, you're one of the guys as well, right? Panth can be a backup opener. He can be a backup wicketkeeper, and he can be a backup middle order batsman. So from that perspective, yes, I guess it makes sense to have Panth in the team. But now you've brought Rahul back after, I don't think, that much first-class cricket practice. So I don't have an answer. I just think it's a bit shocking for me. I do think there is a little bit of a bias towards Panth, and I'm not complaining because I like the guy. But to bring him in for an ODI series happening in India, you're probably going to see the best of Panth in this next 1-2 weeks. So I'm excited, but I'm confused.
Yeah, I think that reflects accurately what we all think, because all three of us actually picked Dinesh Karthik as the finisher in our World Cup squads. And in the next week, he's suddenly been kicked out. And speaking of World Cup squads, Ashwin's squad seems to have got the most number of votes. So congratulations to him. That's why we've kicked him off the podcast this week.
And that's basically because he's Panth in his team. That's the only big factor, but anyway.
Yeah, and he's your player, as you pointed out. Anyway. So, guys, I think that wraps up the discussion part of the show. So, Taz, thanks so much for chipping in with all those amazing insights, especially into associate cricket. I think there's a lot to be learned, and there's a lot of exciting stuff coming up for associate cricket. But the last segment we've got this week, actually, is the answer to last week's quiz question. Ashwin had put that question out, and the question was, who are the only two Indian batsmen to score 100 runs before lunch on any day of a test match? And the answer was, it's Dhawan versus Afghanistan and Pandya versus Sri Lanka. And Taz, I think you were the first one to answer, and you got both of them right. A lot of people got Dhawan. So the people who got both answers right were Taz, Bhavaniisms, Elite Cynic, Cricket Diet, two Pandyas, you know. I mean, with his name, he should have got it right. Kaustubh 45, Shantanu Srivastava, and Arindam Saha got both batsmen right. One batsman that made an appearance was Dhawan, and Saurabh Jain, Kaustubh Pathak, Simply Paru, Zen Cricket, Karthik Jayaraman, Nikhil Arde, and Short Third Man all got 50% of the answer right. Everyone else seemed to think Veeru was the one who scored runs. Oh, there was a couple of Farooq engineers thrown in there as well. So, well done to everyone who got both right. Extremely well done on that. It's not an easy answer. We'll put another question out there on Wednesday next week. So see if you can get that, and we'll tell you the correct answer on next week's show. I think that wraps up the show for this week. So thank you everyone for listening. Do drop us a line on email. It's contact@onetipone.hand. Follow us on Twitter. Drop us a tweet. Send us a message on Facebook. We love to hear from you guys. Leave us a rating on iTunes. Subscribe to us to make sure you get notified of new episodes. And guys, please tell everyone you know about us. That's the only way we grow. That's the way the podcast becomes bigger. We love bringing the show to you and hope you guys like listening to it as well. So Taz, thank you again for joining us on this week's show. It's been a pleasure speaking to you. It's really great speaking to somebody who knows their topic so well, knows cricket so well, and is so interested and passionate about it. So it's been excellent for Varun and me to have a chat with you.
Yeah, it was good fun.
Thanks again.